Hey everyone, this is Pastor Matt. Welcome back to the Grace Life Podcast. I'm here with Josh Bird, and we're walking through Jesus' final week, otherwise known as Holy Week. Today is Friday, and we're covering the events of Jesus on the day of his crucifixion. If you missed any of the previous episodes, you're going to want to pause this one and head over to thegracelifechurch.org or Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube and check out the episodes from this week, where Josh and I cover the events occurring on Palm Sunday through Thursday of Holy Week. Most of us look forward to Friday. The weekend is coming, and it is a day of celebration. But on this Friday, 2,000 or so years ago, Jesus died for the sins of the world. It's a dark day. It's a violent day. And it's a day that changed the world. The wrath of God was satisfied. Here's the plan for our conversation today. We're going to cover the events in the Garden of Gethsemane, the betrayal and arrest of Jesus, and his trial and sentence to death. We won't actually get to Jesus on the cross today because we're going to cover those events tonight at our Good Friday service. Grace Life, make plans to be there tonight. And if you're listening to this podcast after Good Friday, you can check out our website, thegracelifechurch.org, and you can find our Good Friday service and the audio for that sermon there. Josh, a few of the days of Holy Week have been given very specific names. Today is often referred to as Good Friday. Can you explain why it's given the name Good Friday?
Yeah, it's funny because this is one of the earliest questions that I remember Chandler asking me about Jesus and Christianity, because we talk about the crucifixion and what that means. And even when you get into the scourging that took place beforehand and the suffering that Christ underwent. And so it seems like there's a disconnect between that and then calling it Good Friday. But I think the reason that it's called Good Friday is because this is the day that our atonement happens. Jesus takes our punishment on the cross for our sins so that we can be made right with God. And then we all know, again, because we have the benefit of hindsight, that the tomb is empty and that Jesus is reigning and living right now.
So for anybody, for the millennials and older, we would look forward to, at least I did, the Sunday newspaper, because in it, there's a whole section of comics. Josh, did you read the comic section growing up?
On occasion, yes.
So that was, I would go to sports and then I would go to comics. Everything else didn't matter. I guess we probably have to, we may have to explain what a newspaper is. I don't know. It was like social media in print. There was gossip columns, all sorts of things. But there's this one comic strip that I've held on to for a long time because I think it just helps explain exactly what you just said. It's from the comic strip called BC. And in one of their comics, they address this very topic of Good Friday. There's two different characters. One of them says, "I hate the term Good Friday." The other character says, "Why?" The first character says, "My Lord was hanged on a tree that day." The second character responds, "If you're going to be hanged on that day and he volunteered to take your place, how would you feel?" First character just says, "Good." Then the second character walks away and says, "Have a nice day." And I think that just reiterates what you just said, that what we call this day good, despite its dark and violent nature, it is the day Jesus atoned for our sins, and something we should be eternally thankful for. Which leads me to one of the most asked questions I receive every year. I've already been asked this question. Explain to us as best you can how Jesus could have died on Friday and then rose again on Sunday, and it's still count as 3 days.
So I cannot pretend to be an expert on this on any stretch. So take what I say with that caveat, because I have read theories that he did not in fact die on Friday, that he may have died on a Wednesday or a Thursday or something like that. What I would say to that is it doesn't matter when he died. It just matters that he rose again, right? That's the important part. But we have to recognize that the Jewish calendar and how they counted days is not exactly the same as we count days. And for example, he would have died Friday morning, which is one day. The next day would have been that Friday night, which is the second day. And then the third day would have been that next Saturday night going into Sunday morning. So my understanding is that they had a different way of calculating days. And so we have to recognize that we use more of a solar calendar. They use more of a lunar calendar. And so there's just a different way of how they calculate days.
So we have to, when we have this conversation, we really have to just remove our understanding of our calendar and get it out of the picture. Because it's so different than the Jewish calendar. But like you said, ultimately, it doesn't matter. Jesus died and he rose again. That is what matters. So I get the question, and I think a lot of times it's sincere, but then there are some people that are very dogmatic about it. And I'm like, okay, if he died on Wednesday, if I find that out in heaven, I'm not going to be mad. I'm just going to be thankful he died for me. That's where we should land. And I'm thankful that he rose again 3 days later, however that 3 days came about, but it was 3 days. So if we look to this timeline, it picks right back up where Jesus was in the garden last night. They had just left the Last Supper. They are in at the Mount of Olives. There, Jesus has a conversation with them. He tells Peter, "You're going to deny me 3 times." And they leave the upper room and they head over to a place that they went to very often, the Garden of Gethsemane. This is a place that I think Jesus and even the book that we're following through references, this is a place Jesus and his disciples went to often. And in John 18, 2, it says, "Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples." So this is a place Jesus was a lot. I imagine it's beautiful. I imagine it might be a little cooler because it is a garden, and Judas knew they would be there. So Jesus takes his disciples there. And he's on his way to the cross. He's not running away. He's not avoiding it. Jesus is confronting death because he knows that this is the will of his Father. It is here that we see the agony of Jesus and the apathy of the disciples. Let me read Mark 14, 32 through 42. "And they went to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, 'Sit here while I pray.' And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, 'My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch.' And going a little farther, he fell on the ground and prayed that, if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, 'Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will.' And he came and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, 'Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak.' And again, he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And again, he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy. And they did not know what to answer him. And he came the third time and said to them, 'Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It is enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand.'" Let's start with, I think, an interesting anecdote to this story. Is there any significance to Jesus' presence in the garden compared to Adam and Eve in the garden?
Yeah, I think there is. If you go to Genesis 3 in the garden where Adam and Eve fall, right? You see where they betray God. So God lays down the rule of, there's only one law originally in the garden: don't eat from this tree. Anything else is fair game, right? There's no other rules or regulations or laws or anything like that. Then they ultimately betray God because they take the fruit. And that's where the fall happens, where human nature from then on is corrupted, right? Where we are prone to sin and we prefer sin over what we would prefer the ways of God. And so you see that fall in the garden. I think it's really interesting that we come back and we see another garden. And this is when Jesus is about to be betrayed by Judas, but it's also where the atonement begins, right? Because we're going to see he goes through the false trials. He goes through all these different things. And this is where it happens, where the atonement being made to cure us of our sin is being made in a garden, starts in a garden, the same way that our fall started in a garden.
I really love how even we see this in the book of Revelation, how there is usually a garden close by. And here in this one, though, it is directly connected to agony. Jesus is fully aware of what's about to take place. He is asking Peter, James, and John, his closest confidants, to come spend time with him in prayer. But they are asleep. Why is Jesus maybe frustrated with their sleeping while he's praying?
Yeah, and I think it's because Jesus fully recognizes what's about to happen and the importance of it. And I think Jesus brought them there because we have to remember that they were followers of him. They had a very close relationship for him. And he's asking, hey, can you pray with me? Can you be there for me in this time? Because he understands the significance of what's about to happen. And so that's why when he comes back, he says, you couldn't even wait, watch an hour. This is the most significant event in human history is about to happen. And here you guys are taking a nap.
Like Jesus walks back and he's like, guys, what are we doing here? Come on. Have I not taught you anything? We're here to pray. My hour is coming. We watch and pray.
And not only that, but we talked about it yesterday where he told them, one of you guys is going to betray me tonight. One of you guys is about to betray me. So keep on watch. And so they know he's about to be betrayed. And here they are falling asleep on the job.
It's so interesting. And again, we briefly touched on this yesterday. They just, I don't think, are aware of the significance of the moment. And we do have this end of the spectrum to see what is taking place, that the weight of the sins of the world are about to be placed on Jesus. And he knows this. And then he encourages his disciples, hey, watch and pray, which is encouragement for us as well as we are confronting sin in our own lives to be on the lookout and to pray, to spend time in prayer. As Jesus is praying, and at some point there's so much agony that we see as if drops of blood are pouring out of him. What is the significance of what's Jesus, of the prayer that Jesus is praying when he says, let this cup pass from me? Is Jesus having second thoughts? Is he trying to get out of dying for the sins of the world? What is Jesus referring to there?
I think it shows really a twofold thing. One, I think that it's not second thoughts about dying. This has been his entire ministry. He's been saying, I've come, I'm going to be turned over. Like he references going to the cross several different times, even back when, and they'll accuse him of this later on when he says, oh, you said you would tear down the temple and build it back up in 3 days. He wasn't talking about the physical Jerusalem temple. He was talking about his body. So he knew this is where it was coming. But I think he fully understands what is about to happen in terms of that God's righteous anger against sin and the punishment that sin bears is going to be placed upon him, because in 2 Corinthians 5:21 it says, for our sake he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. So Christ, who had no sin, is about to bear the brunt of the punishment of sin. And I think it's really important for us to recognize the severity of that, because oftentimes I think we forget that our white lies, we don't take them as a big deal. But compared to a holy, perfect God, it warrants eternal punishment and separation from God. But that punishment is about to be placed on Christ. So I think he recognizes that. I think he understands it. Because I would say two movies have had an impact on the way that I see the world. And one of them was Saving Private Ryan, and the other was The Passion of the Christ. Because especially if you look up what Roman crucifixion was, and if you look up what the scourging that he would have taken place before that, it's pretty historically accurate. And so I think when we recognize that when he got hit with those whips, when those nails went through his hands, that was us. Like, that was meant for us, and we would rightfully deserve that because of our sin, but he's willingly taking that upon himself. So I think he recognizes the severity of what's about to happen to him. But I also think, too, it's a signifier that this is the only way to God. This is the only way that we can have redemption with God is through Christ. Because if you could be a Buddhist, if you could be a Muslim, if you could be a Jew, if you could be a Hindu, if there was any other way to be made right with God, then the crucifixion shouldn't have happened. If there was any other path, this shouldn't have happened. And so I think the significance of that is also this, that Christ is the only way to be made right with God.
I think of my own life and my own sins. And I'm like, the thought of all of that just being placed on Jesus for me and how thankful I am. And then to think, not just my sins, your sins, the sins of the whole world placed on him. I mean, no wonder he is in agony. He didn't deserve this death. He did nothing wrong. And he is going to be what Galatians 3:13 tells us, he's going to be cursed. Galatians 3:13 says, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. As it is written, cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree. Like, this is far more impactful and glorious than we talk about. Like, what Jesus is doing for us should drop us to our knees in thanksgiving that we did not have to die this death, though we deserved it, that he took our place for us. And without him, without his crucifixion, there is no salvation, just like you said. And yet, despite knowing this, he did not give up. He did not change his mind. He did what only he could do, and he knew his time had come, which is really remarkable because there are people that love those races where you run through mud and you climb things. I can't think of what they're called.
You know what I'm talking about? Spartan races?
Yeah, like a Spartan race. And they just love that stuff. I look at that, I'm like, I don't know why anybody would want to endure that. And I want nothing to do with it. And then I think of what Jesus is doing here. And I'm like, how does he press forward? Like, how does he say, okay, Father, if this is what you want me to do, I'll do it. Like, why? What are we seeing about Jesus's heart there in this moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think we see that he's willing to undergo this, because oftentimes people will say that, oh, this is, you saw this, I think, in a Christian movement in the early 2000s. I believe it was called the Emergent Church, or this kind of like more deconstructionist type of church, where they would say, this is really just cosmic child abuse because you have the Father who is going to send a son in order to do this. And I think what we see here is Jesus's heart of that he loves us, that he was willing to do this and undergo it voluntarily. This wasn't a situation, because again, it could be difficult because God is triune, right? So there's one God, one essence, and three persons. And so it could be difficult to rationalize this, but this wasn't a situation where the Father forced the Son to do this. This was within the Trinity, the understanding of like, this is the way that salvation is going to work out. So it wasn't as if one forced the other to do it. It was in harmony where the Son willingly did this to go through this process.
Yeah, we see the love that Jesus has for us, where he lays down his life for his friends. It's the only way you can describe why he would do this, is because he loved us. And we didn't deserve to be loved. Like, we were his enemies in our sin, born in sin. We were living life against the holy creator, and yet he still loved us and gave his life. Even in the people that put him to death, it's just remarkable to just to sit in and think about. And I think that's why thinking about Good Friday is so good for us every year, to just intentionally think about the violence, the sacrifice, the blood, the nails, the crown of thorns, the whippings, the spear in his side, and the mocking for us. And he didn't back off. He didn't run away. He went head first into the sacrifice for us. So as Jesus is praying and the disciples are passed out sleeping, Judas comes. Give us a quick synopsis of what Judas is doing surrounding his betrayal of Jesus, Judas's betrayal of Jesus in the garden.
Yeah. One thing you said that made me think of something to add this is when you mentioned the mocking, I think oftentimes we think of the suffering that Jesus endured as physical, yes, which that's a large part of it. But I also think the mocking is something that took place as well. Cause I don't know if this is still accurate, but I know a while ago I read one of the most, like the number one public fear, Jerry Seinfeld had a joke about it a long time ago, where the number one fear was public speaking. And the second fear was death. And so he makes a joke of, if you're at a funeral, it's better to be in the box than giving the eulogy. And we think of that. And the reason that is because people don't want to be mocked. They don't want to be made fun of like that. And that's something that Jesus also endured. And if I'm mocked, I might deserve mocking, right? Because I'm a fallible person. But this is like the creator of the universe who is stepping down into his creation and is going to be mocked and spit on. And like the humiliation that would take, that's a part of it as well, yeah, that I thought was interesting. But when we get to Judas betraying Jesus in the garden, I think when you talked about they went here oftentimes and it was somewhere where they would go to pray, this was orchestrated so that it would happen in a quiet, kind of secluded place, because the Pharisees and the Jewish leaders were worried about what the crowds would do if they just took him when he was in the crowds. And so this was orchestrated. And so he comes with some Roman soldiers and things like that to take Jesus, and he's going to betray him. He's going to point out who Jesus is by giving him a kiss on the cheek. And so he's going to go up and give a friendly greeting, which is ironic because what he's doing is betraying him.
After the, during this interaction, we see Peter chop off an ear. We see Jesus heal the ear. We don't see Jesus resisting. We see the disciples scattering. It's a little chaotic at what's taking place from the disciples' perspective. I think the Pharisees think they've won. They know they're finally, we're going to get to the end of this. So what's going to take place over the next couple of hours is there's going to be two trials that Jesus goes through. A Jewish trial and a Roman trial. Now, Josh, you're very familiar with trials. Can you give us a backdrop of why there's two trials? Why did it take place early in the morning? What were the Jewish people seeking to charge Jesus with? What's going on in the early hours of Friday?
Yeah, and so I think the reason that we're going to see two trials, we're going to see a Jewish trial, which is going to be more of like the religious side of it, and then we're going to see the Roman trial, which is going to be before Pilate. Now, the Jewish, what they're concerned about doing is they want to get the idea of showing that Jesus is a heretic, that he's a blasphemer and things like that. And so that trial is going to focus on that. So you'll see they'll take him to the former high priest, Annas, and that's even almost like a way to buy time for Caiaphas, the current high priest, to get witnesses against him and to try to present these false accusations. Because there's a lot of issues with this Jewish trial. It seems like they were violating their own rules. So it wasn't exactly a fair trial, because normally they would never have a trial this late at night or this early in the morning, depending on when exactly it occurred. But you're also going to have the Roman trial. And the Roman trial, what they're going to do is they're going to focus more on trying to say that he's inciting a rebellion or that he's going around saying he's a king, things that the Romans are going to care about, because the Romans aren't going to care about, okay, you guys say this guy's a blasphemer, why do I care? That's y'all's issue. But they have to go to the Roman trial because they want him crucified, and the only ones that could sentence him to death were the Romans.
And what's really interesting is neither of these parties have a legitimate leg to stand on when it comes to this trial for Jesus. Obviously, Pilate's going to realize he hasn't done anything wrong. But Pilate's more interested in keeping peace than he is about doing what's right, which we'll see here in a little bit. But yet, God and his divine sovereignty uses Pilate as a part of this story. There's a lot that takes place in these trials. They're really working hard to make this seem like above board, but it's devious. Like, they're acting what they would say, if anybody else did this, they would call this evil, what they are doing. Here's what happens once daylight has come on between Jesus and the council in Mark 14. Verse 53 says, "And they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes came together. Peter had followed him at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priest and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none, for many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, 'We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that it is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands.' Yet even about this, their testimony did not agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, 'Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?' But he remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?' And Jesus said, 'I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven.' And the high priest tore his garments and said, 'What further witness do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?' And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to strike him, saying to him, 'Prophesy.' And the guards received him with blows." It seems as the night goes into day that the Pharisees' evidence, their trial, it's falling apart. But then a specific question is asked: "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" which is referring to the Father. Why are these verses, not only the question by the high priest to Jesus, but Jesus' response to the question, why are these verses significant?
So there's a lot of different theories on what specific blasphemy he was being accused of. And when you get to verse 62, where he says, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven," there's imagery that he's evoking there of one, Daniel 7:13 and Psalm 110, which says that you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. And so there's a lot of different theories about what specific blasphemy that he was offering from their perspective. So it could have been the claim to be the Messiah, the claim to be the Son of the God, the comment that he supposedly made about the temple, his use of the divine name when he replied, "I am," or his claim to sit at God's right hand. And what the book takes is that the final suggestion that he's claiming to sit at the right hand appears to be most likely, because when he says at the right hand, that's a ruling seat, right? That is a seat of power and authority. And so when he says that, that's likely the blasphemy that they're taking from his statement.
And up until this point, they didn't have a clear eyewitness testimony. And that's very significant to a Jewish trial. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so the Jewish trials, you had to have at least two eyewitnesses in order to adequately testify to something or credibly testify to something. So for example, I forget the actual verse, but Jesus makes reference to this with his miracles. He says, "I testify to it, and then what I'm doing also testifies to it." You see the power of God working through him. That's a testimony and a sign that he's the Messiah, that he's the Son of God, that he has the authority to do what he's doing. And so that's really what we're getting at, is even under their view or their trials, one of the things that they didn't have was they didn't have enough witnesses to actually testify against him of what they were accusing him of. Now, he wasn't guilty of it, but even if he would have been, it still would have been an invalid trial.
Jesus's response, where he says, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven," man, that is, as I was just studying it out and just thinking on it, That is a weighty and incredible response. It just loaded with everything the Pharisees would just hate. And you hit on it already. But it's like, Jesus, I'm going to tell you exactly who I am. I am, and you will see me, the Son of Man, seated at the right. They're appalled by it. And I don't even know. It saddens me that they wouldn't just stop to consider, is he the Messiah? But they don't. They immediately want to put him to death. So they leave the Jewish trial. They've got their conviction. Before we get to the Roman trial, we must acknowledge two events, though, happening on the side. They're like side plot lines with major, just their side plots, which are with, they're wrapping up some other stories that we've talked about. One is Peter denies Jesus three times, just as Jesus had said he would. And then Judas hangs himself. So this is happening in the periphery while Jesus is at trial. And now after the Jewish trial, as he heads to see Pilate, it says in Luke 23, verse 1, and the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, we found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king. And Pilate asked him, are you the king of the Jews? And he answered him, you have said so. Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. But they were urgent, saying, he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee even to this place. In verse 18, it says, they all cried out together, away with this man, and release to us Barabbas, a man who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection started in the city and for murder. Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus, but they kept shouting, crucify him. A third time he said to them, why? What evil has he done? I found in him no guilt deserving death. I will therefore punish and release him. But they were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified. And their voices prevailed. So Pilate decided that their demand should be granted. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they asked, but he delivered Jesus over to their will. All right, Josh, there's a couple of new characters we're introduced to from the Roman perspective. Who is Pilate? Who is Herod? And then who is Barabbas? And why is Pilate and the Roman government, why do they even really need to be involved here? And it seems like they don't even want to be.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting too, where there was so much concern about making sure that they took Jesus in a private place because they were worried about the crowds, and then how easy they can get the crowds to turn against him.
Yep.
To then want this murderer released instead of Jesus. I always find this interesting. But Pilate is going to be the Roman governor or the Roman leader of this particular area where they're in Jerusalem right now. Herod Antipas is what's called a tetrarch, so he was a ruler of another area, which was over in Galilee. Barabbas is described in the verse that we just read, where he is a prisoner who is a murderer and an insurrectionist. So he would have been more possibly like a zealot, where he was trying to overthrow the Roman government, or he was just a murderer, but he was in prison. And so what you see is Pilate and Herod are trying to pass the blame off on one another. So Pilate says, hey, this is a Galilean. Send him to Herod. It's his problem now. And then he goes to Herod, and Herod said, nope, go back to Pilate. And so ultimately, Pilate is the one who's going to put the sentence on Jesus.
Why do you think they would ask, what's the significance of asking for the insurrectionist and then turning Jesus in?
Yeah, I think there's some significance on probably a few different areas. So one, I think it's an innocent man taking the punishment of a wicked man, which is ultimately what Jesus is doing.
Yep.
But I also think, too, it's possibly that they were seeking someone who more fit their idea of who the Messiah was going to be. That the Messiah was going to be someone who was pushing for an earthly kingdom, who was an insurrectionist, who was going to revolt against Rome and things like that. Thinking on in that terms, I think that's probably some of the reason that they were seeking for Barabbas to be released instead of Jesus.
And here's what I think is interesting. Oh, go ahead.
Because Barabbas, if he was an insurrectionist, didn't seem like he was going after the Pharisees' power. Jesus was. he was saying, or the Sanhedrin too, Jesus was saying, hey, he confronted him. It didn't seem like Barabbas was a threat to them in that way.
And it doesn't seem like Barabbas is a threat to the Roman Empire. Like, they're not like, okay, we'll let him go. I think if he was a major threat, they would have said no. But it seems like they're more interested in peace in the area. And if they're just trying to keep the Pharisees and religious people happy, all right, you can have this guy back. He's not really going to – we're not concerned. We'd rather have the peace. Does it seem like that a little bit to you too?
Yeah, which is interesting because he's asked, is your kingdom of this world? And he says, if it was, my followers would be outside rioting and doing the same things that essentially what the Pharisees are trying to get the crowd to do. Which I hesitate to say this because of kind of the politics of it. And I think that there's enough argument that you can make it on both sides. So I feel like it's fair. Like, I have had that thought when I've seen some of the riots going on in different cities and in different places and things like that too. Is this the appropriate way for Christians to respond in what we see as injustice? And like I said, I feel like both sides have done it. So I'm okay saying it on this. Yeah. But I've always had that thought in the back of my mind because Jesus is saying, hey, if my kingdom were of this world, we'd be rioting just like they are outside.
Yeah. Pilate's conversation with Jesus is always really intriguing to me. I want to know, I think he's very curious of Jesus, just based on some of the questions. And I really just, I started thinking about it a couple years ago when we were preaching through the book of John, and I just captivated by Pilate's interaction with Jesus. And it says in John 18, Pilate said to him, Jesus, so you are a king? And Jesus answered, you say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. Pilate said to him, what is truth? And after he said this, he went back outside to the Jews and told them, I find no guilt in him. It appears that Pilate may recognize two very key characteristics of Jesus, his truth and his sinlessness, or at least he hasn't done anything deserving of death. Why is this interaction between Pilate and Jesus heartbreaking?
We see a lot, right? He finds him sinless, he finds him not guilty, and then he's going to sentence him anyway just for pragmatism. So that's an issue. And then he's asking, what is truth? And he's literally staring truth in the face because Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And he just completely ignores him or can't see him. And I think too, like even in our age where we try to take things that are objective, like gender, for example, and say, no, it's subjective, right? It could be anything. It could be a spectrum. It could be whatever you want it to be. Or like a cringe saying that always makes my blood boil a little bit, live your truth.
Yeah.
Like truth is not subjective. Like truth is objective. There is objective truth in the world. And that is ultimately found in Christ and what God says, right? God created the universe. He created truth. So what he says essentially goes.
We're not going to be able to get into the events of the crucifixion. Eventually, Pilate washes his hands and says, I'm not responsible for what happens to Jesus. He's trying to cover his own tracks. And they don't say, let his blood be on our hands and our children's hands, which is just very regrettable from the Jewish people's perspective. Pilate sentences Jesus to the crucifixion, and he's flogged and whipped and mocked and all of that. But the story of Pilate doesn't end at the trial. He makes another appearance after Jesus' death. In Matthew 27, verse 62, it says, the next day, that is, after the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate and said, sir, we remember how that impostor said while he was still alive, after 3 days, I will rise. Therefore, order the tomb to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people he has risen from the dead, and the last fraud will be worse than the first. Pilate said to them, you have a guard of soldiers. Go make it as secure as you can. So they went and made the tomb secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard. All right, now on this side of Resurrection Sunday, these verses are hilarious. Go and make it as secure as you can. And they did, and Jesus said, not secure enough. I'm still going to conquer death. But what is happening here? What is the significance of the interaction between the Pharisees, the Pilates, and their concern about what will happen now that Jesus is dead?
Yeah, I think it goes back to show the planning of God, that he will take things and make it to where what actually happened is more believable. Let me explain it this way. So the Pharisees are coming to say his followers are going to steal his body and say he rose again because he made these prior statements. So then they say, secure it, put a giant stone in front of it that can't be moved by people, right? And then put guards in front of it. And that God is essentially defeating that argument before it can even happen, because had it not been guarded, then there might be people believing, oh, they stole his body and they lied about it and things like that. But here you can't believe that because they specifically put guards in front of it and put this stone that you couldn't roll away. And then sure enough, Jesus comes out.
The phrase go and make it as secure as you can really shows how little power the most powerful of men have. They cannot conquer death. Only Jesus can. Josh, it's really been a pleasure to sit down with you and walk through the final week of Jesus. I've really enjoyed it. It's just been good to, for my own heart, as I've just prepared to have this conversation. But I want to ask you this question. What are some of your takeaways as you've studied and we've had these conversations on the podcast? What have been some of your takeaways from the final week of Jesus?
Yeah, I think that it's really been good to sit down and study this in an orderly way, because one, recognizing the importance of it and how it is like such a large chunk of the Gospels, this one week in the life or the earthly life of Jesus has been really good. And then to see, because I think sometimes when we read scriptures, it goes so fast, where it goes from this event to this event, that it can almost seem disconnected. And I think sitting down to focus on chronologically what was happening has been really good, to see it as one complete story, as opposed to like disconnected fragments of, oh, here's a parable. But to see what Jesus is doing as we're guided along this week. And then ultimately the sovereignty of God, to see, we talked about it on the triumphal entry, the donkey, right? I think it was on the first day we did this, like the sovereignty that was there, the fulfillment of that prophecy. We just see so many fulfillment of prophecies that couldn't have taken place but by the sovereignty of God, to highlight who Jesus was and what was going to happen.
I want to say thank you also to William Cook III, if he ever happens to listen to this, for writing this book. And if you didn't get a chance to get it and read through it, it's a great book. It's just easy to read. It was helpful for our conversation. But it also reminded me that this is not Jesus's final week. From a earthly perspective, death is final. Jesus's death was not. And because Jesus's death was conquered and he rose again, our death is also not the end. For those who are in Christ, we, in our moment of death, will be ushered into the presence of the one who died for us. And for that, I am thankful. Josh, once again, thank you for being on here, spending time with you. It's been good. I want to close out today by reading the words of the famous hymn written by Isaac Watts in 1707. As we prepare for our Good Friday service tonight, and we'll talk about the events of Jesus, and this coming Sunday, we'll celebrate his resurrection. But let me close with these words that I think summarize really the entire week. When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss, and pour contempt on all my pride. Forbid it, Lord, that I should boast, save in the death of Christ my God. All the vain things that charm me most, I sacrifice them through his blood. See, from his head, his hands, his feet, sorrow and love flow mingled down. Did e'er such love and sorrow meet, or thorns compose so rich a crown? Were the whole realm of nature mine, that were a present far too small? Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. We began this week with an invitation to find your all in who Jesus is. And I pray that this podcast that Josh and I have recorded has been an encouragement to you. But we ultimately know that there is nothing like the grace of Jesus. And it is a privilege to tell his story and to reflect his glory. Thanks, Grace Life, for listening. And we look forward to celebrating with you on Easter Sunday. God bless.